Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to those who recognize, even those who are open to the realization that all of the world's religious, political, military, economic, and also media institutions are corrupt, counterproductive. They can't be fixed. They are working against your interest. And more than that, that if you're going to come to know who God actually is, if you want to engage in a relationship with Him, you would like to be saved by Him, then you must absolutely and unequivocally disassociate from those human institutions. We're going to talk in the first hour as to why they're rotten to the core. But we do that not because there is any solution. There isn't. We're not advocating that you try to save your country. We're not going to advocate for one political party over another. We're not going to propose any economic solution, any social solution, any military solution. There is none. There is nothing that can be done to prevent the collapse of virtually every country in the world, but most certainly the United States. And so all we want is for you to recognize why this was going to happen so that you can be one of the few who's not marauding around like zombies, unaware of what's being done to you. And so that ultimately a few of you, it may be as few as one in a thousand, who are open to the realization that this is happening, will take that first step away from an allegiance to country and religion, and then we'll take that next step, and we'll take the time to come to know who God is, understand what He's offering, and respond. That is why we do this program. It's the only reason we have done this program over the past several years. Taliban forces, we learn, advanced on the capital of southwest Afghanistan. The province is Helmand Province. It was the center of the Taliban activity and control some years ago, 15 years ago. And they've been fighting with government forces. They have cut off the major highway, Route 1, that runs between there, the areas in Kunduz and the center of Afghanistan, Kandahar, in terms of the center of political power. There's civilians continuing to flow in large numbers. In fact, under the Taliban, there was a very small exodus. You know, when the United States decided to play proxy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan by aiding the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, arming them, there were about 2.5 million Afghans that fled that civil war to save their lives from American aggression. We, of course, blame the Russians, as we are doing in the Ukraine, as we are doing in Syria. Jimmy Carter even boycotting the Moscow Olympics when the United States knowingly and deliberately started that war, just as the United States knowingly and deliberately started the riots and the Ukraine that have led to the mess that we're witnessing, just as the United States deliberately and knowingly started the civil war in Syria. These are not speculation. There's absolute proof of all of those statements. We are the most menacing country in the world. And the last time we played this game in Afghanistan, 2.5 million Afghanis fled the country as refugees. Under the Taliban, many came back. And there were very few refugees under the Taliban. That's not to say the Taliban was charming. No, they were a fundamentalist Islamic organization. They were ruthless towards women. They treated everything that any civilized individual would view as immoral, unethical, and criminal as good, and anything that we would consider in the West as good, they considered halal as bad. Or actually halal in Islam means good. It is Satan's name. Haram is bad. And so here we are. We're playing the game all over again. It's not that we didn't learn a lesson. It's that our malfeasance is deliberate. Don't think for a moment the United States went into Afghanistan as revenge against 9/11. No Afghani perpetrated 9/11. No Afghani had killed an American. There were no Afghanis that were part of the 9/11 suicide bombing. Don't think for a moment that we went in because we didn't like the Taliban. We had rendered the Taliban. The Taliban was our enemy. We used the Taliban in a very successful, if you want to call murderous, an immoral war against the Russian-backed government, the secular government there. So there was, and you can't say that it was because of a war on terrorism, because terrorism has increased incalculably since we invaded the country. You can't say it was to liberate women, because women are treated more poorly in Afghanistan now than they were previously. But the fact is that what we did not only increased terrorism and diminished the quality of life for women there, it created a sea of refugees. This time it's not 2.5 million. This time it's closer to 4 million. Yeah, there's a lot of chatter about how many Syrians are coming into Europe. But the fact is, there are nearly as many Afghanis in a much smaller country flooding Europe as a direct result of the misguided, counterproductive invasion by America. And now the Taliban, throughout that country, has reasserted its influence, and they are now on the Highway 1, the main transport artery linking the southern city of Kandahar with Herat, and they are in control. It is going to be like Vietnam all over again, which is what I predicted 15 years ago, that we wouldn't know who the good guys were and the bad guys. In fact, there would be no good guys. We would put up a puppet government that would turn to be incredibly fraudulent and wouldn't inspire anybody to defend it, that would simply steal the money that we squandered there. We would try to arm, creating an army for the native people, as we did in Vietnam, only to fail miserably. We would stay in Afghanistan to keep from admitting that we had failed and that all the Americans that had died there had died in vain, just like we did in Vietnam. We would lie about every aspect of the war, and we would kill lots of civilians. And in the end, we would leave the country broken. We would have sacrificed American blood and coin, making a bad situation worse, just as we did in Vietnam. Predicted all of those things would occur. And yet, there isn't any American out there that's saying, we really screwed up. That was a misguided decision. We ought to indict George Bush, Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, et al. For treason, because they made America vastly more vulnerable. We could indict them for murder, considering the number of people from Afghanistan that were killed and the numbers of Americans. We could indict them for crimes against humanity, for the torturous implementation of that war and the tactics that America used to increase terrorism. And so here we find ourselves unwilling to admit any of those things, unwilling to accept responsibility for the calamity that we caused. And most Americans are clueless in this regard. They're clueless to the fact that in Afghanistan, the warlords that we are arming, the warlords that we are enriching, the warlords that we are giving an army to, and that we're putting in charge of the country, routinely take little boys, kidnap them from their homes, strip them naked, chain them to beds, and sodomize them. That they murder little girls when men rape them. They flog these girls before they stone them to death when they're the victims of rape. They torture dogs just for fun. That's their entertainment. And so here we are, unwilling to admit that what we have done has failed, that there is no chance of success, that we made a bad situation worse, that we invaded on a pile of lies, and that we have stayed based upon a pile of lies. But how many Americans recognize this? Well, admit it. Know it. Own it. How many of you that voted for George W. Bush will accept responsibility for what your vote enabled? You know, if you listen to Daddy Bush, he would tell you, though, that his boy had nothing to do with the ill-fated invasion of Afghanistan. No, that was not his idea. It was Dick Cheney's idea. It was Rumsfeld's idea. It wasn't poor little baby Bush. No, he would never have done that. Well, I'm here to tell you that I met George a year before he became president. I spent an hour with him in the State House in Texas, down there in Austin. And after a long private discussion with him, I asked him why he was running for president. And he said, because I know I will be good in crisis. And so I want to be a president over a time of crisis. I said, you must mean war, certainly. He decided that he was going to go to war before he became president. 9/11 was his excuse. He had declared war on the Taliban and on Afghanistan 6 months before 9/11 occurred, and declared that he was going to put America in a state of war a year before he became president. And you know, and Afghanistan isn't even his most glaring, most murderous mistake. I can't call it a mistake. Malfeasance. His most glaring act of treason, his most immoral act, his most deadly decision was the invasion of Iraq. When he decided that he would squander American blood and coin invading a country that had nothing to do with 9/11, that did not have weapons of mass destruction, that was an ally of America, not a threat to America. And when he made that decision, he set off the forces that are now at play in Syria and the rest of the Islamic world, changed the world forever. Expect our politicians to lie. They lie most of the time. But why don't we hold them accountable when their lies cost thousands of lives? Realistically, George W. Bush's lies about Afghanistan and Iraq cost in the range of 250,000 American lives as a result of those who have come back based on the stupidity, the immorality of what he orchestrated and have taken their lives. It's beyond the 10,000 Americans that have died in those two conflicts, killed in theater. It's beyond the 50,000 Americans who've come back, their bodies mutilated as a result of George W. Bush's deception, delusion, visions of grandeur. It is something that when you find out that your president knowingly lied about the smoking gun and the yellow cake uranium, knew at the time it wasn't true and yet used it as the pretext for an invasion. When he knew for a fact that there was no al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, and yet he used it as a pretext for the invasion. When it was obvious that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and yet he had his Secretary of State, Colin Powell, what a criminal that man is, present to the United Nations this whole, what a mythology, on this truck and that truck, and we know this came from there, and it's hauling that, when they absolutely knew squat. And yet we invaded. We broke the country. We took the country away from a secular dictator, and we gave it to the Iranians. And then we armed the Iranians, and they started killing the Sunnis. And then the Sunnis started to defend themselves, both of them wanting to kill Americans, but at each other's throat, and we decided the only way to prevent an absolute slaughter of the Sunnis is the awakening program, and we'll mask it under the name of the surge, and that stalemate will make it look like we've prevailed. We've declared victory. And I said at the time that all this is doing is making certain that the ultimate consequence of a civil war between Sunnis and Shias in Iraq will be devastating. And it turned out to be just that. Because as the Shia from Iran started to bomb Fallujah and other Sunni cities with American weapons, the Awakening Program warlords that had been part of the Saddam Hussein regime used the weapons America had given to them, and they struck back. And in defense of their people, they pushed the Shiites out of all of the Sunni majority areas, confiscating all of the weapons that had been stashed there, and all of a sudden now you had a formidable force. And the Islamic State in Iraq became the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, as they realized there was really no border there, and that the majority of the Muslims in Syria were Sunni. And then they just became the Islamic State, as they had tremendous success, all because America, under George Bush, made a hellacious decision, a murderous decision, an immoral decision, a counterproductive decision. And yet we don't hold him accountable for this war based on lies. Hundreds of thousands of people killed in Syria now as a result of his decision. 8 million refugees, between 1 and 2 million already in Europe, destabilizing Europe forever. And more weapons being poured into the region, more and more countries engaging in the region, and it's now a certain catalyst for World War III. All because of George Bush. And yet we don't indict him. We don't hold him accountable. He's out playing golf there somewhere in Texas between his two homes, one in the suburbs of Dallas, the other in a ranch there outside of Waco. No one holds him accountable. When we learned that he and his team had approved torture, no one indicted him. No one held him accountable. When we learned that his Department of Homeland Security was a ruse to spy on Americans, to establish a national Gestapo, to breach the U.S. Constitution, no one held him accountable. No one indicted him. If we don't hold people accountable, if we don't indict people to crimes, how are we a government under the rule of law? What value is the Constitution? What value is the sworn oath they have made to defend it? What value is the country? Under such leadership, what merit has a country that the majority elects such dishonest people? And he may have been better than the man who followed him, Barack Hussein Obama. In the Maldives, that's a vacation area. It's a tropical paradise, if you will, but it's unfortunately it's under the control of Muslims. A woman was found guilty of adultery. The woman reportedly gave birth out of wedlock and was convicted in the magistrate's courts. The island nation had previously issued flogging sentences to those convicted of having extramarital sex. Now, keep in mind, that's the stupidity of the journalist. They only issue the flogging sentences to the women. The men are never even criticized. But the stoning by death sentence for this woman, and nothing for the man, is part of Islam. In 2013, the case of a 15-year-old girl was, she was sentenced to 100 lashes after being found guilty of premarital sex. Imagine that. You can't even survive 100 lashes. Imagine the agony of that. A 15-year-old girl. And the High Court of the Maldives, an Islamic court, was going to order her to have 100 lashes. Well, extramarital sex is illegal in the Maldives. Although, guess what? In the Maldives, you can have four wives. So that would be extramarital, wouldn't it? And in the Maldives, you can have that fourth spot be a rotating spot, so a man can have as many wives as he would. But a woman, no, that's not the case. A woman can only have one husband. So the rules aren't the same for men and for women. So it's not that extramarital sex is illegal. It's that women have no rights, no freedom. They are owned by men, to be abused by men. It's also interesting, of course, that Muslims are too stupid to figure out how could it be that extramarital sex is illegal in Islam and punishable by stoning to death or by 100 lashes, and yet the reward for killing for Allah as a jihadist is multiple virgins in paradise. Doesn't say it's multiple wives in paradise. Multiple virgins, extramarital sex, is the reward for acting badly. Now, you'd think that since the Quran reaffirms this over and over again, that multiple virgins, no one's wife, are the reward for killing in the name of Allah. And that killing is appropriate if someone performs that same role on earth, you lash them and kill them, that maybe there's a conflict there. Maybe that you can't have a reward in your God's paradise that is considered inappropriate on earth. Hmm? If you're a Muslim, why don't you read those parts of the Quran and say, boy, that's really stupid. Or why don't you just read the 8th surah of the Quran, where Muhammad admits that he went to the Badr raid exclusively to rob his former neighbors, to rob a civilian enterprise. He went to Badr as a thief. That's the first raid in Islam, where he killed many people, mutilated their bodies, gloated over them, kidnapped individuals, sold them off for ransom. It's the first act in the Islamic era. Why don't you pay attention to your own religion as opposed to playing religious dress-up? It's amazing that the ignorance of Islam is run so extreme. Scott, some time ago you sent me this. I never did read it on this program, but St. Cloud, Minnesota. Harsh words and heartfelt sentiments were exchanged by community members and local officials on racial issues in central Minnesota. Did that St. Cloud incident, did it involve any racial issues, Scott, or was it a religious issue? Oh, I'm sorry. You sent me about a month ago your governor in St. Cloud, when people were protesting about, you already have this blight on the city, which no one works, where the crime is rampant. This is called Little Mogadishu, and they were going to bring in a bunch more Somalis.
Yes.
Did the people protest because they were in fact, I'm not even sure there is a Somali race, but that they were, was it a racist protest, or was it a religious opposition that people said we're concerned about?
They were concerned that bring more people in wasn't the thing to do. I mean, they didn't really mention they never really mentioned any religion or race. It was, why are we bringing more here? We have more than enough type thing. And the governor's response to any complaints was, you either, you know, if you don't like it, you can leave. This is how Minnesota is, and if you don't want to be here, don't be here.
Yeah, look around you. This is Minnesota.
Yeah.
Dayton said, Minnesota is not like it was 30 or 50 years ago.
He also said that
Minnesota.
We need these new immigrants so that way we can fill jobs.
Yeah, except they're not working.
No. We also don't have an overabundance of jobs here that are trying to be filled.
Oh. Yeah, he says, you have a right to be here to the Muslims in Minnesota. If you are intolerant, if you are that much of a racist or bigot, then find another state, the governor said. Yeah, your state doesn't belong to you. If you don't like the fact that we're bringing in another blight, we're adding it to the blight, that we're adding to the number of Muslims that are in this state that aren't working, that are creating a criminal problem, that wants to be governed by Sharia law, that view jihad favorably. If you don't like that, if you don't like the fact that Islam condones rape and kidnap and the enslavement of little girls, and jihad, and mass murder, and terror. If you don't like that, then you just go find another state to live in, because you're not welcome here.
Isn't that great? I'm born and raised here.
Yeah?
Born and raised. I've been here in Minnesota most of my life. You know, I've lived a few other states, but I've been here most of my life. I've paid almost all my taxes in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And
If you don't like giving your money to people who are ungrateful, who want you dead, then you have to leave.
And the worst part is that the complaints weren't even directed at a religion or a race. It was directed more as, why are we bringing these people here? You know, what's the reason for this? Haven't we as a state helped enough during this thing? We have the second highest population of Somalians outside of Somalia.
Yes,
in Minnesota.
But you can't tell me that Minnesotans are ignorant of the polls of those Muslims. And the polls of those Muslims saying they want to be governed by Sharia law that condones rape, condones mass murder, that condones terrorism, and that condones the mistreatment of women, and that they're not aware that it is the most criminally active area in Minnesota.
I would hope the smart ones are. I know I am. There's a million more reasons why I don't want them here.
You know, if you were doing something that was counterproductive in business, let's say that you had a customer that every time you shipped them something, not only didn't pay you for them, but then used your product to harm you in some way. Would you continue to do business with that customer? Would you say, you know, that's probably counterproductive?
Well, I'm not. No, I would not. I definitely would not.
What's the difference between that and Minnesota and the Muslims from Somalia?
There is no difference. There is no difference. The people that are complaining, I'm in agreement with. The ones that are complaining for, we don't want these people here. They're moving here. We don't want to become. We're Minnesota.
Right.
You know.
You don't want to become Somalia. You don't want to become an Islamic country. Just look at the Islamic countries. You don't want to be like them. But they want to bring that hell to Minnesota. It is astonishing. You know, there was a televised interview about 2 weeks ago with the Grand Ayatollah Ahmad al-Baghdadi. He is probably the second highest, maybe the least, the third highest ranking Shia cleric of Iraq. And he said some very interesting things. First, he said that he spoke about defensive jihad. And he said that all Muslims are obligated to fight. Now, defensive jihad is for the liberation of occupied territory. For example, Israel. Now, you tell me how Israel is occupied territory when Israel was occupied by Jews going back to 1000 B.C. And that the first Muslim didn't invade Israel until almost 700 C.E. And so that was 1,700 years later that they became the occupiers. And that at the time, the country was occupied by the Byzantines because the Romans had been so murderous as it relates to the Jews. So the Byzantines were occupying Israel, and then the Muslims kicked the Byzantines out, and they occupied Israel. But from the point of the moronic Muslim, they're ordered to fight a defensive battle against Israel because Israel is Jews are occupying Israel, which they consider Muslim. Now, how do you reason with that kind of people? Truth doesn't matter. History doesn't matter. Logic doesn't matter. Sanity doesn't matter. So any territory that's ever had a Muslim in it because Islamic, and if it's, for example, now, with millions of Muslims going to Europe, it's now Muslim territory. When they fight jihad in Europe, it will be defensive jihad. They will be defending themselves because they're now occupying Europe. Amazing. He explained offensive jihad, which is Islam's primary bloodline, which forged, as he said, the Muslim world over the centuries. According to the Ayatollah, they can, when circumstances permit it, when they are in a strong position, they're obligated to go on the offensive and to conquer non-Muslims. Now, that's should be frightening when you consider the number of millions of Muslims that are flooding the West. The Muslim cleric, third highest ranking cleric in Iraq, a man that we empowered, he had no power in Iraq at all until the American invasion. He repeatedly yelled at the secular host, who kept interrupting him and protesting that Islam cannot teach such violence and intolerance. At one point he burst out and says, "I am the scholar of Islam. You're just a journalist. You need to listen to me." He then said, "They are the people of the book, Jews and Christians. We demand of them the jizya, which is the mafia had a similar concept. They called it insurance. The mafia didn't take as much as the jizya, and they didn't treat those who paid them the jizya as revoltingly as Muslims do. But the purpose of the jizya is to confiscate anyone who doesn't submit to Islam's wealth. You take their property, you take their possessions, you take their earnings. You make them pay for your unwillingness to work. But with the jizya, it's not just the jizya. It's not just that you are going to support the monster. If you want to live in an Islamic-controlled area as a Christian or Jew, talk about grotesque intolerance. And this is the nature of every Islamic country. But you actually have to, according to the Quran, submit to the Muslim, recognize that you have been subjected, that you have no rights, literally no rights, and that you are nothing but a piece of dung. Yeah, that's the nature of Islam. And he says if they refuse, then we fight them, we kill them. That is, if he is a Christian. He has the three choices, according to al-Baghdadi. Either convert to Islam, or if he refuses and wishes to remain a Christian, then pay the jizya and live according to the many rules, which means that he has no rights whatsoever. To be treated, killed, flogged, starved, whatever, imprisoned, no rights. But if they still refuse, then we fight them, and we abduct their women, and we destroy their churches. This is Islam. Come on, learn what Islam is. Are you even a Muslim? Al-Baghdadi, the cleric that the United States empowered when it invaded Iraq because Saddam Hussein wouldn't tolerate that. But Americans obviously do. Speaking of Christians, the very man that America empowered says that if he's a Christian, he has three choices. Convert to Islam, or if he refuses and wishes to remain a Christian, then confiscate his money. Make him pay the jizya and live according to the many rules where he has no rights whatsoever. But if he still refuses, then, you know, we're going to fight and kill him. And we will abduct the Christian women. And we will destroy their churches. This is Islam. As for the polytheists, the Hindus and Buddhists, we will allow them to choose between Islam and war. This is not the opinion of Ahmad al-Husseini al-Baghdadi, but of the five schools of jurisprudence, four which are Sunni and one which is Shia. Now, towards the end of this interview, because of the clean-shaven and suit-and-tie-wearing host, and he kept protesting, "This cannot be Islam," the Ayatollah burst out, pointing at him with contempt and saying, "Who are you? You're going to tell me what to believe? What I'm telling you is the word of Allah." And indeed it is. In the Muslim community, jihad is a religious duty because of the universal nature of the Muslim mission and the obligation to convert everyone on earth to Islam, either by persuasion or by force. The other religious groups did not have a universal mission, and jihad was not a religious duty for them, save only for the purpose of defense. But Islam is under obligation to gain power over all other nations and all people. Allah was sent, this is again from the lips of the most respected Muslims. Allah was sent, or has sent us, and brought us here, so we may free those who desire from servitude to earthly rulers, and make them servants of Allah, that we may change their poverty into wealth and free them from the tyranny of chaos of religions and bring them to the justice of Islam. He has sent us to bring his religion, which is the most unjust ever conceived, the most impoverished ever conceived, the least free. Even the religion name means submission, surrender. I mean, it's amazing that a Muslim can say these things, knowing that all evidence demonstrates the opposite is true. He has sent us to bring his religion to all creatures and call them to Islam. Whoever accepts it will be safe from us, and we shall leave him alone. But whoever refuses, we shall fight until we fulfill the promise of Allah. The Saudi legal expert, Bashem Alam, echoed this view. As a member of the true religion, Islam, I have a greater right to invade others in order to impose a certain way of life according to Sharia, which history has proven to be the best and the most just of all civilizations. Yes, just Sharia, based upon the words and deeds of Muhammad, exclusively. Muhammad was a rapist. He was a pedophile. He was incestuous. He was a mass murderer. He was a thief. He was a ruthless terrorist. He engaged in the slave trade. He kidnapped for ransom. He was an avowed liar. And yet that is the basis of Sharia, and this high-ranking Saudi Arabia cleric is saying that it is the most just of all civilizations. This is the country where the royal family cuts off their maids' arms, tortures them with nail guns, burns them, pulls out their fingernails, does everything that they could possibly do to torture those who do their work. The most just of civilizations. This is the true meaning of offensive jihad. When we wage jihad, it is not in order to convert people to Islam, but in order to liberate them from the dark slavery in which they live. And yet, Islam is surrender, servitude, submission. It is truly amazing that the world is so tolerant of this disease. But nonetheless, they are. I stumbled upon an article sent to me by a listener to this program the other day that was from someone who had come across the book of Barnabas. It's called The Gospel of Barnabas, but as we know, there are no Gospels. But just to make it sound like it was amongst the rest, there's a book allegedly penned by Barnabas. It dates back to the 4th century. Now, Barnabas, as we know, since it dates back to the 4th century, we have no idea if it was actually written by the Barnabas. But it certainly expressed the conclusions, the opinions of those much more current than we are in terms of what had happened and who was right and who was wrong. The primary impetus of the book of Barnabas, Barnabas was the fellow that accompanied Paul to the Jerusalem Council when Paul was called on the carpet for being opposed to the Torah and opposed to circumcision and for creating his New Testament and New Covenant and claiming that that the entire world had been given to him. And Barnabas came with Paul, but immediately thereafter they split. And so Barnabas was in a position to know emphatically that Paul was a complete and utter fraud. And so the book of Barnabas, which we now date back to the 4th century, acknowledges that. The basis of the book is to say, in fact, it calls the wannabe apostle, Paul, the imposter. The book was found in Turkey. It's a property of the Turkish government. It was been snatched by smugglers. It's been all around the Middle East, been in Tehran for a while. But it's thought that during the Council of Nicaea that the Catholic Church decided what to include and what not to include, and the Book of Barnabas was available to them, but they decided not to include it. Tells you a lot about the very nature of the church. And it is amazing that Rome would build its Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, and name the center Saint Peter, because Peter would have criticized everything they stand for. The fact is that Roman Catholicism is based upon Paul's letter to the Romans. It should be called Saint Paul's.